Chapter 12. Yellowish ooze, made up of microscopic skeletons from a marine plant called the diatom, slowly drifted away in serpentine clouds, shrouded by the total blackness of the abyssal deep. The bottom of the gorge, where the Numa mining station once stood, had been filled by silt and rock slides into a broken, irregular plain littered with half-buried boulders and scattered wreckage. There should have been a deathly silence after the final rumblings of the earthquake died away, but a warped chorus of Minnie the Mermaid rose from under the desolated wasteland and rippled out into the liquid void. If one could have walked over the debris field to the sound source, they'd have found a single antenna shaft, bent and twisted, poking up through the mud. A grayish-pink ratfish briefly inspected the antenna, but, finding it unsavory, flicked its pointed tail and lazily swam into the dark. Almost before the ratfish disappeared, the silt a few meters from the antenna began to stir, swirling in an ever-widening vortex that was weirdly illuminated from below. Suddenly, a shaft of light burst through the ooze, joined by a mechanical hand shaped like a scoop and articulated at the wrist. The steel apparition paused and straightened like a prairie dog standing on its haunches and sniffing the horizon for a coyote. Then the scoop arched downward, gouging through the seabed, excavating a deep trench that began to ascend at one end like a ramp. When it struck a boulder too large to fit in the scoop, a great metal claw appeared magically alongside. The claw's talon-like pincers bit around the boulder, yanked it free from the sediment, and dropped it clear of the trench in a billowing mud cloud. The claw then swung clear, and the scoop continued digging. "Nice work, Mr. Pitt," said Plunkett, grinning with relief. "You'll have us out and driving through the countryside by tea time." Pitt lay back in a reclining seat, staring up at a TV monitor with the same attentive concern he usually reserved for a football game. "We are not on the road yet. Boarding one of your deep-sea mining vehicles and running it into the air pressure lock before the major quake hit was a stroke of genius." "I wouldn't go that far," Pitt muttered, while programming the vehicle's computer to slightly alter the angle of the scoop. "Call it theft of Mr. Spock's logic." "The airlock walls held," Plunkett argued. "But for fickle providence, we'd have been crushed like bugs. The chamber was built to withstand four times the pressure of the other project structures," Pitt said with a quiet, unarguable assertion. "Fickle providence, as you call it, gave us time to pressurize the lock, open the outer door, and move forward enough for the scoop and claw to operate before the avalanche struck. Otherwise, we'd be trapped for longer than I care to think about." "Oh, bloody hell," Plunkett laughed. There was little that fazed him. "What does it matter so long as we cheat the grave?" "I wish you wouldn't use the word grave." "Sorry." Plunkett sat in a seat beside and slightly to the rear of Pitt. He stared around the interior of the DSMV. "A damned fine machine. What's its power source?" "A small nuclear reactor." "Nuclear, eh? You Yanks never cease to amaze me. I'll wager we can drive this monster right across the bottom and onto Waikiki Beach." "You'd win your bet," said Pitt with a faint grin. "Big John's reactor and life support systems could get us there. The only problem being a flat-out speed of 5 kilometers per hour. We'd die of starvation a good week before we arrived." "You didn't pack a lunch?" Plunkett asked humorously. "Not even an apple." Plunkett gave Pitt a dry look. "Even death would be a treat if I didn't have to hear that blasted tune again." "You don't care for Minnie?" Pitt asked in mock surprise. "After hearing the chorus for the 20th time, no. With the telephone housing smashed, our only contact with the surface is the acoustic radio transmitter. Not nearly enough range for conversation, but it's all we've got. I can offer you Strauss waltzes or the big band sounds of the 40s, but they wouldn't be appropriate." "I don't think much of your musical inventory," Plunkett grunted. Then he looked at Pitt. "What's wrong with Strauss?" "Instrumental," Pitt answered. "Distorted violin music can sound like whales or several other aquatic mammals through water. Minnie is a vocal. If anyone on the surface is listening, they'll know someone down here is still sucking air. No matter how garbled, there's no mistaking good old human babble." "For all the good that will do," said Plunkett, "if a rescue mission is launched, there's no way we can transfer from this vehicle to a submersible without a pressure lock, a commodity totally lacking on your otherwise remarkable tractor. If I may speak realistically, I fail to see anything in the near future but our inevitable demise." "I wish you wouldn't use the word demise." Plunkett reached into a pocket of his big woolen sweater and produced a flask. "Only about 4 swigs left, but it ought to keep our spirits up for a while." Pitt took the offered flask as a muffled rumble shook the big tracked vehicle. The scoop had screeched into a mass of stone and attempted to lift it clear. Far beyond its load safety level, it struggled and groaned to hoist the debris. Like an Olympic weightlifter straining for the gold, the scoop heaved its massive burden above the seafloor and dumped it in a growing mound along the trench. The outside lights failed to penetrate the mud clouds, and the monitors inside the control cabin showed only constantly merging colors of yellow and gray. But the computer monitor gave a three-dimensional sonar image that displayed the extent of the excavation. Fully 5 hours had elapsed since Pitt began the digging operation. At last he could see an enhanced display showing a narrow but reasonably clear corridor slanting toward the surface of the seabed. "We'll scrape some paint off the fenders, but I think we can squeeze through," Pitt said confidently. Plunkett's face lit up. "Kick her in the butt, Mr. Pitt. I'm sick to death of staring at this filthy muck." Pitt's head tilted slightly, and he gave a wink of one green eye. "As you wish, Mr. Plunkett." He took over manual control from the computer and rubbed his hands like a pianist about to play. "Cross your fingers the tracks get a firm grip on the sediment, or we'll have to take up permanent residence." He gently eased the throttle control forward. The wide-track crawlers on the sides of Big John slowly began to move, churning through the soft ooze, turning faster as Pitt increased the power. Gradually they inched forward. Then one track caught and gripped on a layer of small stones, slewing the giant mining machine into the opposite side of the trench. Pitt fought to correct, but the wall gave way, and the mud flow spread over one side of the vehicle. He rammed the throttle against its stop, then pulled back as he shifted into reverse, then full forward again as he rocked Big John back and forth. The compact nuclear reactor had the power, but the tracks could not find the traction. Rock and silt flew from the pivoted cleats as they ripped through the slimy gumbo. Still, the DSMV remained stuck in its narrow prison. "Maybe we should call a halt and scoop the mud off," said Plunkett, dead serious. "Or better yet, sit back and review the situation." Pitt spared a few moments to give the big Britisher a hard, icy stare. Plunkett swore Pitt's eyes burned out a goodly number of his brain cells. "A lot of my people and I worked hard and long to build the first deepwater community," he said in a voice that bordered on satanic. "And someone, somewhere, is responsible for its destruction. They're also the cause behind the loss of your submersible, your support ship, and its crew. That's the situation. Now, speaking for myself, I'm going to bust through this crap if I have to tear the guts out of this thing, get to the surface in one piece, find the scum behind the disaster, and punch their teeth down their lungs." Then he turned and sent the tracks thrashing through the encasement of silt and rock. With an awkward wobble, the great machine dug in and lurched a meter forward, then 2 meters. Plunkett sat like a tree, thoroughly intimidated, yet quite convinced. "By God," he thought, "I think the man might damn well do it."